And I work in quantum gravity. So we have a group here at PI in quantum gravity. And I want, since you're going to, you know, see some faces around, I wanted to introduce you to, you know, some people and what they are doing here. So we are four faculty at the moment. You know, I'm one of them. We have two senior faculty, me and Lee Smolin. And here are the picture there. So Lee is the one of the founding members of PI and one of our oldest, you know, more senior faculty. And he works in many different area, which, you know, which include the, so quantum gravity is a, you know, is a broad subject, a very specific subject that I'm going to tell you more about, that I'm sure maybe you have heard a little bit about. But it's also broad because it touches on many different aspects, which are physical or mathematical. So he works a bit on cosmology. One of his team is, you know, emergent gravity. I'm going to list what are some of the people I'm going to show you doing here. It gives you a broad idea of what people are, you know, are now doing here. He's interested, as I am, into phenomenology. Of quantum gravity. So is it possible to test quantum gravity? And related to that, some issue which I'm going to talk about, which is non-locality. And then he did many, many things. He did particle physics, you know, GR, usual GR, and, you know, lattice GR, SUSY, etc. He has done, you know, he's a very broad scientist, very knowledgeable in many areas. One of his big areas is also foundation of quantum mechanics, which is another area that maybe you have heard about. Okay. The next one here is one of our young faculty. She's starting this year. Oops, where is it? Bianca Dietrich. She's from, Lee is, you know, originally from the US. Lee's PhD in Harvard. Bianca did a PhD in Germany. She was a postdoc here, and she's going to come here. She works in loop quantum gravity, canonical loop quantum gravity. So canonical means Hamiltonian, and then she works also in you know, discrete approaches to quantum gravity. Semi-classical limits. When you're doing quantum stuff, you would like to be able to link it to classical objects. Okay, and she's a leader in, you know, some of this area here. And Fotini, I don't think you will see her this year because she's on leave, but she'll come by on and off. And she's mainly interested into emergent gravity. So is it possible, let's say, for some kind of statistical system or any type of other system to emulate gravity? Is gravity something which is fundamental or something which is emergent? That's one of her main activities, let's say. And she's a big proponent of that type of approach. And then we have many postdocs which are, you know, coming from all over the place. Fotini is originally Greek, and she did a PhD in London. What else? Okay. So these, you have a, you know, you could now you can recognize them if you see them. Okay. How can I move these things? Okay. Well, that's okay. So our postdoc, Razvan, very energetic postdoc, is one of our 5-year postdocs. So he can be here for 3 or 5 years. And he's from Romania. He did his PhD in France, in École Normale. And it's his first postdoc, but he will stay with us for long. Why? And he works in, when you deal with quantum gravity, as I mentioned, you have to deal with some aspects which are about statistical objects. So let's say space-time is going to become a dynamical entity, quantum entity, and there's some statistical component to it. So he's doing a bit of, he did a lot of quantum field theory. He's a specialist of non-perturbative renormalization. And then he's doing statistical mechanics. But the reason he's one of our main postdocs is because he's developed something which is called group field theory, which is a way somehow to resum a bundle of quantum space-time together and find a field theory version of it. It's like some type of third quantization. So you'll see field theory. Which is a second quantization. So I'm mentioning names, and Yamiro, of course, you'll understand them maybe better as time goes. Joseph is also working in a lot in group theory and statistical mechanics. Valentin is also the relation between the Hamiltonian and path integral, version of quantum gravity. And this path integral is called spin foam, okay, which is a big subject here. And this one is loop quantum gravity. So this is the relationship between loop quantum gravity and spin foam. Okay, and Cecilia is, which is going to appear here, is doing well. Mostly we are sharing her with the Foundation of Quantum Mechanics. So she's doing some conceptual work on quantum mechanics, which we have. A relation on, understanding the structure of space-time. So, foundation of space-time here. Okay. Space-time. And, okay, Tim. Yeah, Tim is doing lots of loop quantum gravity, canonical, but he is developing something which is called shape dynamics, which is essentially the realization that you can formulate usual GR in terms of something which is a conformal field theory. And he has his own program, as much as Razvan has his own program on group field theory. GR as CFT. Jome will talk about CFT, I'm sure. And Leonardo is doing quantum black hole. So of course, one of the mysteries of gravity is the black hole, but what happened at the quantum level? How do they behave? How do they radiate? How do, is the singularity still there? So people worry about that in cosmology and for black hole. Leonardo is working on that. And Eugenio is working a lot on spin foam, which is the dynamics of quantum gravity, and also on black hole. The statistic of it, etc. So that gives you an idea of what people are doing now. And of course, it's always changing because the boundary and the frontier is changing. So at least now you spend some time looking at them. So they'll be more familiar to you, I guess. I don't need that anymore. OK, I don't need the screen anymore. That's what I wanted the screen for. Cool. Okay. Any question on that? I did not show you the students. I don't have their, for some reason, not all of them have their picture on the website. I know that's not what I wanted to do. Oh, I cannot do twice. Oh, okay. You can do only one thing at a time. Wow, that's dangerous. So you're not supposed to drink coffee, right? That's
No.
That doesn't.
Okay.
That's okay. Right.
You can put your coffee
there. Wow, that's true. You have to know. So it's only for.
And you can put all three together, but of course not two.
Oh, you move three, but not two.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a law behind that?
It's just presets. You can have these. I guess there. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, cool. Okay, presets. Cool. Cool. So let me just try to give you, you know, broad through, I don't know, quantum gravity, the problem, and what people do here, and maybe what I am thinking of right now, but, you know, very broadly and without too much details. And then you can ask me questions or ask questions. Now that you know them, you can ask questions to these people. They're very knowledgeable, and, you know, you can grab them when they walk around. So, okay, quantum gravity, where is the beast? You know, quantum gravity. Of course, nobody really knows, right? That's why I have a job. And that's why maybe you'll be here and some of you would be interested. You know, we have lots of ideas about what it is, but there's no final universally accepted theory for it. And that's one of the main challenges. And the main challenge is to put together, you know, the principle of general relativity, and, you know, and quantum mechanics. And for some reason, they fundamentally just clash together. And you need some conceptual a breakthrough to move on and to develop that type of theory. So historically, there's been essentially, let's say, two main roads to think about the problem of quantum gravity. And in fact, the historical roads, or even I'm thinking even recently, there's even a third road. Each time there's a new approach on some conceptual problem like that, it sometimes comes because of the way the question is framed. Let's say there's this clash between these two. And then you have to think about what is exactly this clash about. And depending on how you present what is the fundamental tension between these two, you're going to take one route or another route. And that's why sometimes when you think about a problem like that, it's always good to go back to the basic and ask the question, OK, what is really the problem? In some sense, part of the difficulty of quantum gravity sits in the questions, as, you know, most creative things you're going to do. 80 or 90% of the work is in the right question. But anyway, historically, there's been maybe two routes. One route is, you know, people were in the community of particle physics. And historically, this has been the first one that has been developed. We're thinking about the problem of quantum gravity as just, you know, gravity is another force, top of electromagnetic, weak, strong force. And then the problem of quantum gravity is a problem of unification. How are we going to put all these forces together? You know, unification problem. And in that approach, you treat gravity as one of the extra forces, and you look at it in some sense on the same ground as the other type of interactions you have around. And this led to string theory. You know, that's a very shortcut. Okay, that's one type of approach, and you can start to think about how you're going to unify all the forces. Another approach is that you really take head on the fact that gravity is a bit different than the other force because it touches on something that is space-time. That is, it touches on something which is usually the theater in which, you know, the play is played, right, which are the particles. And that means that you focus on an approach which is a geometrical approach. So in fact, the community of people who developed that other approach are people who are doing, you know, a classical GR people. And they focused on the, you know, what could be the geometry of quantum gravity. And essentially, the question here is, you know, what is really the nature of quantum geometry? Quantum geometry. what is quantum space-time made of? Is there something that it's made of that, you know, it's not really made of points. It's made of something else at the quantum level. But what is it? Is there a way you can describe it? You know, is there a way you can manipulate this object? How do you build up a bigger structure? How do you explain, you know, the fact that for us it looks like it's something smooth and stable and that doesn't move and we'll agree on what it is, whereas it's something, you know, very quantum and dynamical and that can be, you know, created and transmuted in many ways. So how do you deal with that? And you see that this is a different type of or sets of questions. You know, what are the fundamental degrees of freedom you have to deal with? Okay? So these are somehow the two main problems. And let's say I'm going to focus more on the geometrical approach because this is, you know, most of the people I mentioned and myself, this is the approach I'm mostly interested in. And I'm sure you'll hear about the other way of thinking about quantum gravity. There are many different ways of thinking about the problem, or the many different type of questions you can ask, and therefore many different probe you can use, physical probe you can use to address the problem. Well, I already say that, you know, the fact, GR tells us, what does GR tells us? GR tells us that space-time is dynamical. Okay. It's not a fixed entity. It's made of something that moves and reacts to the matter and you know, and wiggles and sends waves. This is a dynamical entity, and I'm sure you're going to have, or maybe you started to have a course on GR already?
Next week.
Next week, okay. So then you're going to learn that on general relativity, right? And then quantum mechanics tells you that, well, you know, in usual, let's say, naive sense, there are many things, you know, in quantum mechanics, exchange of energy are made of quanta, and clearly, you know, energy couples to, in general relativity, the energy creates the notion of geometry, curves the geometry. So therefore, you expect that at some level, this quantization of energy exchange is going to transmute to the geometry. So there might be something as such as some type of quanta of geometry, but what are they? How do they make up? You know, these are the things you would like to understand. What is the nature of geometry at the quantum level, this quantum geometry? And how do you even talk about it and describe these objects? Okay, in order to appreciate the problem, maybe you have already seen that. So quantum gravity, you want to put quantum mechanics, which is characterized by a Planck constant h bar, and then gravity, which is characterized by g newton. Okay, so what happens, and let's say there's also c, but, you know, c relativity, so speed of light, let's put it to 1. Okay, so what happens when you have these two constants? When you have these two constants, you can construct something which is first a length scale. So if you take Planck length, so once you have these two constants, there's a fundamental length scale which arises in the problem, which is Planck length, Lp squared. So h bar g, which is a product, has a dimension of a length square. And you know, if you put the numbers here, you see this is extremely small length scale, 10 to minus 33 centimeters. And you can also put, there's also a mass scale, Planck mass, which is h bar over g is mp squared. And the Planck mass, well, depending on what you compare it to, is either extremely big, 10 to the 19 GeV square. Okay, big because if you look at what maximum acceleration we can reach in a particle accelerator in the LHC, the LHC is, you know, around 10 TeV, which is 10 to the 4 GeV. You see, it's like, so if you would like to use an accelerator and you know, probe quantum gravity with that type of accelerator, you'll have to go 15 order of magnitude higher than that to really see the quantum gravity world, you know, in front of your eyes. Well, if you use your regular unit, you know, in gram unit, this is 2 to the 10 minus 5 gram squared. So, you know, it's very light. I mean, that is if you have a big object, you know, a ping pong ball is above the Planck mass. Okay? So, Okay, so what happens when you have these two units? Then the problem is that you fundamentally don't know what is the structure of space-time at the shorter scale, because the way you would try to know what is the structure of space-time at the shorter scale is that you would take a particle and, you know, use this particle as some kind of light to probe the geometry. This is what we do, right? We use either light or proton in accelerators or electron that we accelerate, and then we use this. The things we can see are always smaller than the Compton wavelengths of the particle we look at. So if we look at we have a particle and it has energy E, its Compton wavelength is going to be, you know, h bar of E, okay? But now if you put gravity, so this is the quantum mechanics part, right? But now if you put gravity, so this is quantum mechanics, but if you put gravity and you put some amount of energy localized somewhere, it's going to create a black hole. And the radius of a black hole is G times E. Okay, if you put a mass somewhere, the mass, you know, will be invisible below a radius, which is the Schwarzschild radius, which is the, you know, because below this radius, the escape velocity becomes higher than the speed of light, and nothing can escape. Okay, so essentially, the problem comes that suppose I want to probe something. The problem comes that if the Compton wavelength is smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, what happens is that I try to see something very small, but then in some sense what I'm going to see is enclosed into a black hole. Therefore, you know, I don't get any information out of it. And if you work out when that happens, that happens when, you know, the energy is bigger than the Planck energy, or when lambda is smaller than the Planck length. Okay? So essentially, it tells you, you can do the same reasoning, let's say, for the hydrogen. The analogy would be the hydrogen atom. You take the hydrogen atom, and you look at, and you take the hydrogen atom and quantum mechanics, and you say, well, till when can I believe the story that the electron around the hydrogen atom is really going around the circular orbit? And you would say, well, how would I know that it's going around the circular orbit? I would send some light there, right? Okay, so I would send some light, which means that I will, you know, put some energy there. Now, in order to see this electron moving around, I need to be able to capture this energy. So the electron has to capture the photon that I send. So in order to see this you know, electron orbiting, I have to send you know, an energy high enough such that I can resolve the distance. So I have to send an energy such that the component wavelength of my photon is smaller than the Bohr radius. Okay. But if you do the computation, what you will find that the energy you have to put in is going to be, you see, the lambda is going to be smaller than a certain thing, the Bohr radius. It means that the energy of the photon has to be higher than the ionization energy. So what's going to happen is that you're going to send your photon and you're going to ionize your atom. Okay? Because if you capture the photon, the electron is going to be kicked out. So this is, in that sense, that there's no such things as an electron orbiting around an atom, because you could never see it, okay? And of course, the proper description is in terms of this overlap of wavelength. So here it's a reasoning of the same sort, right? That you take the theory as you know it, and you see a limitation. That is, there's no way you can ever tell what's going to happen there. And you need, in some sense, to complete your understanding there to describe, you know, what's going to happen. So that's one, you know, one particular way to see some type of conflict between the two. Any question on that? Maybe the lesson from this is that in quantum gravity, there is a fundamental non-locality. And I'm going to come back to that. Okay? See, you're shy, talking too much. Okay, that's fine. Okay, let me now browse a bit what some people are doing here and maybe explain. You say fixed. No, there's one. How do you do the three? Which one?
So.
Which one did you want? I don't know. Okay, fine. Just choose this. That's cool. Wow. So you don't have to think anymore about what you're doing. So I mentioned something which is one of the basis of what many people do here, is called loop quantum gravity. And maybe you have heard the word. So I just want to tell you a little bit what this is and what people do very rapidly. I'm scared, you know, I'm worried I'm going to go a bit too fast, but we'll see. So in loop quantum gravity, what you do is that you really start from the point of view that gravity is a quantum theory, and you really treat gravity as an Hamiltonian theory. Okay, so you formulate it. And then you put an extra twist, which is that you promote quantum gravity as a gauge theory. In the same way that you know QED is a gauge, is a U1 gauge theory, in the same way that the strong forces are non-abelian gauge theory. So what does it mean to treat gravity as an Hamiltonian theory? The object of study of gravity is space-time. So this is space-time. And then you know, at a given moment of time, you have space, which is here, right? And space-time is equipped with a dynamical entity, which is the space-time metric. So now, what does the space-time metric leave you, you know, as an imprint on the space slice at a given moment of time? There's two objects that it leaves. First, there's an induced metric, gamma mu nu, which tells you, you know, what is the distance at a given moment of time to go from one point to another. But there's also something which tells you how the space-time slice is embedded into your space-time. And this is called the extrinsic curvature, which tells you whether your slice is embedded in a flat manner. It could be intrinsically curved, but it could be externally curved too. So these are the two pieces of data. And essentially, gamma, which is the metric, you can think in terms of quantum mechanics, p and q variables. So this is like q variable. This is the position, okay? And k, the extrinsic curvature, is like p. It's a conjugate variable. They are Poisson conjugate variables. And then you have an Hamiltonian, which is of the form something like k squared, and then there's maybe a curvature term. And then, you know, maybe there's some source term for cosmological constant, and maybe some source term for G mu nu, T mu nu, let's say, matter field, etc., like that. The problem, or the feature of gravity, is that there's no notion of energy, okay? Energy does not exist. So there's no notion of energy. What does that mean? It means that the theory, you know, energy is the object which is conjugate to time evolution. To define notion of energy, you have to fix what you mean by time, and then you look at how things change with time. Okay, good. Now the problem is that time in GR, it's a coordinate. And there's a fundamental symmetry of general relativity, which is coordinate invariance. You can change any type of coordinate. So you can pick a time. That's a choice of coordinate. Somebody else can pick up another time. That's another choice of coordinate. They might be radically different, and they will lead to different notion of energy. And so none of them are really physical, right? Because physical entity are really defined in terms of physical observables. So there's no preferred notion of energy in gravity. And the only question you have is that, so usually, you know, when you have an Hamiltonian, you want to diagonalize its Hamiltonian and look for its energy level. You know, H equal E, and then you quantize these objects. Here in gravity, the only question you're going to have is that H is equal to zero. So this Hamiltonian here, this is the dynamical equations of motion of gravity, is that it satisfies, it's called a constraint, which is the signature of any gauge theory. Once you have, it's called Noether theorem, once you have a gauge symmetry, you have a constraint associated with it. Okay, H equal to zero, and because there's no notion of energy, there's no preferred notion of time. Which is, you know, and sometimes there's some approximate notion of time. Let's say in cosmology, you imagine that maybe you have a scalar field, and you're going to define time by being, you know, the value of this scalar field when this value is constant. That gives you a moment of time. The problem is that sometimes in evolution, this this subject, which defines you constant slice of time, becomes time-like, and therefore is no longer a good notion of time. So these are all these issues that are, you know, kind of new in GR. Yes?
Maybe a question. I mean, when you try to get the Hamiltonian itself from
yes.
the Lagrangian description of GR,
yes.
don't you have to explicitly show that you have to?
So you pick up, yeah, you locally say, okay, you know, M is of the form sigma times an interval, T.
Yeah.
But then you, the fact that, in fact, you can do that in many ways, so you have a freedom. And then you see that, in fact, the thing is that you vary with respect to this freedom, and you say, well, nothing should change. So it does, the physics, you know, the physics looks different in different choice of time, but in fact, the physics should be invariant. And this equation expresses that invariance. Okay. So it's the general case in a theory when you have a notion of gauge invariance, there will be, the theory doesn't depend on certain parameter in theory. Now, if you vary with respect to this parameter, you get an equation which is a constraint equation that tells you nothing should change when you change this parameter because these parameters are totally unphysical. There's no measurement I can do that will measure them.
One question, but when you have a gauge invariant theory, the Hamiltonian is always zero. You have to at the constraints of the Hamiltonian, right?
Yes, yes. So usually you have an Hamiltonian and then you have constraints. The problem is that when you have time reparametrization invariance, then it turns out that the Hamiltonian is the constraint. Okay. So in general, yeah, there's a time and there's constraints, but if you know if your gauge symmetry involves changing the notion of time, then your Hamiltonian becomes the constraint. Okay? So, okay, so the what people try to do is say, okay, well, it's easy. I should just put a hat on that and try to quantize and find states and try to solve these objects. And this is called the Wheeler, the Witt equation. The problem is that, you know, it's very hard to make sense of that. And people tried in many, many, many years without much success. There's lots of understanding coming from there. So in loop quantum gravity, what happens is that you put an extra twist. You work with kind of different variables. Instead of working with a metric and an excentric curvature, you work with a magnetic field and an electric field, A and E. So the magnetic field is a connection. Connection tells you how to transport object, right? When you have a geometry is two things. Geometry allow you to measure distances, and a geometry allow you to go from one point to another. So a geometry is a metric and it's a connection. It's both things at once. So A is a connection, and connection is, I think you have seen it in QED or, you know, a strong force. And the electric field is related to the metric. So the metric is like the square of the, you know, there's an index like that. And then, okay. So the electric field is the geometry. Okay. So you just reformulate the fact that a geometry is two things, something which is metrical that allow you to measure, but also something that allow you to transport. And then the equation of the geometry are relationship between how you measure things, how long they are, versus how they rotate when you move them around. Okay, that's what a geometry is telling you. In these cases, the Hamiltonian is a bit simpler. And then what people have done is construct a and it's easier to quantize somehow and find out what are the proper bases of states. So people look for states. I think you were doing quantum mechanics here. So when you look for bases of states, what you do is that you have to choose a polarization, let's say P or X polarization, and you want to look for the wave function here. And there's kind of a unique basis of states, a very nice basis of states that can be constructed from mathematical principle, which is called the spin network basis. And it follows more or less from the fact that you have the symmetry of diffeomorphism invariance, the fact that you can move things around freely. And the spin network basis, I'm just going to draw a picture. Essentially, it's a graph, okay? And then the edge, are labeled by spins, which carry information about the flux. Okay, and in this picture, what happens is that now you have states which are of this form, let's say these kind of discrete states, polymer-like states, and you can start to ask, okay, what is the geometry associated to this type of states? The things you have to understand now is that the notion of geometry you see, let's say you want to measure, let's say the area, you have a surface, give me an example, and you want to measure what is the area of this surface, okay? Now, because we're doing quantum mechanics, the area of a surface is an operator in quantum gravity. So it's not a number, okay? It's an operator acting on your Hilbert space. All geometrical objects you're used to becomes now operators in this basis, and you can compute what is the spectra of this operator, and you can show that in fact these states, these spin network states, are eigenstates of geometrical operators. And for instance, the area operator is expressed as a sum over all edge of L Planck square GE plus 1. Okay, this, you know, there's a spin per edge. And then the same thing, the volume of a region is going to be given by the sum over the nodes associated with the graph of something which depends on the nodes, like that. So the main thing that you get out of that is that at the kinematical level, geometry, quantum geometry, is discrete in the sense that geometrical operators have discrete type of spectra. Okay, so that's something which is a bit different. And from there, than the usual picture, and from there, there's been many developments, for instance, trying to, well, one of the main developments will be the notion of black hole entropy. So black hole have a property of behaving like statistical object, and one of the big mystery is if they behave like statistical object, all statistical objects we know are usually made of little bits, small pieces. So, you know, how to count them? And to black hole, we can associate a notion of entropy, which is finite and proportional to the area. So there's this famous Bekesh-Hawking formula that, you know, for LP squared, that the entropy of a black hole is the area in unit of the Planck lens, area of a 4. So, you know, there's many, many attempts, whether it's in string theory or in our game, to try to understand if you have an entropy, you should have a certain number of discrete degrees of freedom that you're counting, and you should account for them. And these are the fundamental degrees of freedom that quantum gravity is made of. Okay, so this recurring idea about understanding this Bekenstein-Hawking formula is also a big theme transversal to many different approaches in quantum gravity. Okay, maybe let me. So this is, you know, the canonical version of it. Why can't you do two? Be convinced to be able to do two. Anyway. Oh, I don't want that. Okay. So one thing that people are doing too, which is in fact in the field what most of people are doing, is called spin-four models. So now I've described you some kind of the kinematics of what quantum gravity state looks like in this picture, and then you would like to understand how they evolve in time, and now I describe space-time, not only space, but space-time. And this is essentially what people call spin-form. They call it spin-form because if I look at this kind of evolving spin network, what I will get is, yeah, let's say I have something that starts like that and end up, you know, I don't know, like that. At some point, I'm going to have a, I'm not sure I can draw it, but at some point, I'm going to have a some kind of creation of a vertex coming in here. And it's going to look like, you know, some surface evolving in time, and which is a foamy surface labeled by these spins. And what people do is that you want first to be able to associate an amplitude to that. So you describe space-time now as some kind of quantum amplitude. And then you have to be able to sum over these amplitudes. Okay, and then you want this amplitude to satisfy certain nice property and reproduce the notion of classical geometry. And then you want to be able to couple them to matter. So there's many recent results and many recent developments. Some of them have been taking place here. In fact, most of them. And the result is that now there's some nice definition of this amplitude, and you can look at the notion, you know, there's a nice notion of semi-classical limit. So there was an open question for a long while. You know, this is a description which is so far from the usual description of space-time that it makes sometimes, you know, it's easy to solve certain problems, but then it makes it harder to make connection with other type of results. So one of the breakthroughs recently has been to being able to connect and show that these models have the right semi-classical limit. And then there's, you know, people computing, you know, graviton propagator, and then all sorts of, well, understanding and development. I don't really have time to do that. But essentially, spin foam is about the dynamics of quantum states of geometry. And then maybe I can tell you a little bit about what I'm currently doing. So I took I spent lots of time doing spin foam model and developing the dynamics and participating to these results. The thing I do many different things, but one thing I'm really keen on thinking these days is this issue of locality. Okay, so the main point is that this is the big elephant in the room in quantum gravity. How are you going to ever measure a quantum gravitational effect? A quantum gravitational effect of general relativity. Is it even measurable? Right? So why am I, you know, am I asking the question? I'm asking the question because of you saw the smallness of the length scale, Planck's length. And that's a big problem for any work in quantum gravity. That is, you can propose theories, but at some point, you know, you should be able to make predictions, and predictions that confront some type of experiment. So the problem is that suppose you want to detect one naive experiment. The typical experiment is you say, okay, gravity is a theory about graviton, which are the particles of gravity, you know, the small excitations of the geometry. And these graviton, you know, they should be quantized like photon. And therefore, I should have some grain of gravity, which are these graviton. And then I should be able to, in the same way I can capture photon individually, I should be able to capture or see a quantum graviton, you know, individually. Okay, what would it take to do that? So let's say you do a LIGO-type experiment. You know a bit about LIGO? So LIGO is a interferometer. So it's just like, you know, a big laser. It's an experiment. It's the biggest experiment that's done today to detect gravitational waves. So it's a detection of gravitational wave. Okay. And it's a very simple experiment in the detail. What you do is that you have you have a beam splitter, okay, and then you do an interferometric experiment between two mirrors. And essentially, you know, you tune your mirror and what you want to do is measure the length of this path to a precision which is about, as I say, 10 to the minus 15. Okay? So what does it mean? It means that essentially, let's say you tune your mirror such that the two paths, you know, the two things interfere coherently at one point. And suppose that, you know, if you stretch this arm, it will change the interferometric pattern. And you will see the band of interferences moving around. Okay, so if there is a gravitational wave moving around here, what does the gravitational wave do? A gravitational wave, what they do is just change the notion of length and notion of time. So if a gravitational wave passed through, it changed the length of that arm in a different manner than the length of that arm, and therefore if you can measure the distance sufficiently precisely, you see that. Okay, and that's really what people are doing. And essentially they're measuring, I think the arms are about like 5 to 10 kilometers, and the precision of measurement of the position of the mirror is about the angstrom. And they make something which is, so they measure a distance of about 200 kilometers at the angstrom type level precision. Okay, so they can see half an angstrom displacement, 100 kilometers. So it's extremely precise and beautiful experiment. Okay, So now suppose you would like to do that, but you would like also to be able to detect a quantum graviton. If you do the calculation, you see that the problem is that you need to have a very heavy mirror, because at some point, if the mirror is not heavy enough, you're not going to be able to, because of the uncertainty principle, you're not going to be able to locate the position of the mirror precisely enough. And therefore, the uncertainty principle will prevent you from seeing the mirror moving. Okay? So you need a very heavy mirror. And if you do the computation, you realize that, okay, the mirror has to be so heavy that it sits inside its own Schwarzschild radius. Okay, so that's not very convenient, right? I mean, as an engineer, it's painful, but so that's not really good. Okay, so that takes a while. Now, if you want to do an LHC type of experiment, so here, you know, no good because looks like the mirror has to be so heavy inside its, you know, Schwarzschild radius. Okay. So if you do a type of LHC experiment, you say, okay, well, what I'm going to do is have a big accelerator, right? And then the problem is that with accelerators that, you know, you send your particle, you accelerate it, but you want it to be back, right? So you need to have something that circles around. And the faster you go, the bigger your accelerator has to be because you know, you have to take into account that you're going to be at the speed of light, essentially, right? Accelerating things at the speed of light. And essentially, if you try to compute what type of radius you would need, you know, what type size of accelerator you would need in order to see a quantum graviton, it looks like it should be as big as the galaxy. Right? So this is the galaxy size. That's not very practical either. So people are trying, you know, still to devise and see what they can do with seeing an individual graviton. But clearly, it seems this is not going to be how you're going to detect quantum gravity. And that's why some people, in fact, do not worry about quantum gravity. I find personally, you know, because they say, well, I'm not going to see it in any tabletop experiment. Personally, the problem is that if you think in theoretical physics, you see that the problem of quantum gravity creeping in all sorts of possible ways. Conceptually, it's absolutely unavoidable to think about it. But, you know, there's still this practical version that, okay, maybe you don't really need to do it. Yes?
Could there be a cosmological experiment?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, not ruling here all possible experiments, but I'm proposing. You know, people should think creatively about. There are some type of experiments. In fact, the details of how these you could go around these things and is interesting. Yeah.
If you have discrete space time, then if you have really long distances, shouldn't that affect things?
Exactly. So now here I was talking about detecting, you know, thinking about gravity, let's say, in the particle physics language, right? That is, you know, if I think of gravity as a particle physics, I should see a new type of particle, a new type of interaction. So now I can think of experiments which are, let's say, seeing gravity more in the geometrical language. So let's say if space-time has some kind of substructure of some sort, discreteness, granularity, then there might be a way, and in fact, this is what I'm going to say. So I think these type of experiments are of, you know, very little hope. But there may be another hope, which is, in some sense, seeing when you see the discreteness, in some sense, we all know, at least everybody agree, on the fact that quantum gravity is a non-local theory. Maybe it's discrete with the fixed lattice. Maybe it's some other form of probe. You know, there are different models for that. But there's this fundamental non-locality. And therefore, maybe one way to really probe gravity is by trying to access directly the non-locality of quantum gravity. Okay. You know, whether it is some kind of granularity, discreteness. But essentially, the fact that space-time, at some level, very vague level, should be thought as some type of media of some sort. Okay, and we have different models for what it is. So, and look at the problem of, okay, so that's a new way. The problem of non-locality is that, okay, everything you have learned so far, and everything you're going to learn in this year, and everything you're going to learn in the next year and the year after in physics is based on the hypothesis of locality. Everything. Like, it's you know, even your brain, even the way you think about, you know, it's like it's what you breathe, what you eat, what you, the way you have been formed so far. So trying to develop a framework where you can think in terms of non-locality. By locality, I mean, you know, there's something which exists, which is a space-time, and we all agree that it's there because we're all sitting in this room, and we all agree, you know, that there's a point there that we can, you know, locate, and we think it's the same thing we're talking about, all of us, and it's something that I can identify independently of my experience, my physical experience, things like that, right? This is really what physics is about. It's based on this hypothesis. So what you really need if you want to embrace non-locality, well, in fact, this is what I'm advocating right now, and this is what we're developing since a year ago, is really to, okay, just face honestly the fact that you'll have to be able to, you should be able, or you should try to embrace non-locality. You should try to be able to deal with this weirdness, to deal with the fact that maybe space-time is not something that exists independently of your experience. Maybe space-time is not something universal. You know, space-time is somehow an illusion, something that you're reconstructing. And then you have to understand the process of this reconstruction to access the details of how you probe it. The beauty of non-locality is that since all of physics, because I was talking about phenomenology, since all of physics is based on this hypothesis of locality, all the predictions so far that people have tried to make in the context of physics are within this hypothesis that physics is local. So once you get out of locality and you allow physics to somehow have an interesting non-local behavior, you're facing a wealth of extremely weird type of prediction. So that's a good news, because it's a good news and a bad news. It's a bad news because you say, well, you know, I'm used to this very, you know, the fact that we believe everything is local is based on our experience. So I don't want things to, you know, non-locality to appear absolutely non-local, like, you know, you're here, there, and then at the same time you're somewhere else. So, you know, you don't want to have this weird effect popping in your face, but it's very good because, as we say, the scale of quantum gravity is so small that the only way you could hope seeing it is by really predicting extremely weird effects. And then trying to scale them away, like this granularity of space-time. A good example is quantum mechanics. That is, you know, if you don't know quantum mechanics, you just know that anything that happens is of the order, an action is of the order h bar, okay? And that's very small. But now we know how to devise systems in which are macroscopic systems which behave quantum mechanically, whether it's squids or lasers or, you know, or condensed matter systems. So by knowing the theory, we can really beat the odds of the smallness of the number. So that's the hope here. And let me just mention how you can think about that and what we did. So we have a framework which is called the principle of relative locality. So it's a new principle of relativity, locality. And it goes back to, as I said, the question, okay, why is it so hard to put together quantum mechanics and quantum gravity together? So I told you one thing, is that if I try to probe something at shorter scale, I get a black hole. Another way to look at it was proposed by Born the guy that invented Born reciprocity rule, which is the rule of computing probability in quantum mechanics. It's the following, is that, in fact, if you think about the two theory, GR tells you something very specific. It tells you, okay, there is something which I call space-time. And space-time has the property that it can be curved. Okay. But if you think for a moment, when you do physics, not only, or when you do quantum mechanics, space-time is like the variable Q I was talking about, or the one you had on your paper. But there's also the conjugate variable, the momenta, energy and momenta. So physics is about combining measurements on position, but also energy, and then putting them together and having a prediction about how they evolve respectively to each other. So space-time if curve, but momenta, energy and momenta, what is it in this picture? A momentum space is just the space of velocity, and it's a tangent space. Because it's tangent, it's flat. Okay, so there's fundamental inequality between the notion of Q and the notion of P, notion of space, notion of momentum space, you don't treat them the same way. As I was saying, in some sense, you know, you can still talk about position of point, but the energy doesn't exist in gravity. Right? Now in quantum mechanics, what is the, if you try to extract, you know, one fundamental principle, there are many ways you can look at quantum mechanics, and people are debating vividly on that. But let me take one way. One principle of quantum mechanics that I want to emphasize is this kind of symmetry principle, which is born bond duality. Okay, what does it mean? It means there's some kind of perfect symmetry between space and momentum space in quantum mechanics. I mean, as you were, maybe it was even written like that. You can describe, you know, physics by labeling function of in terms of the position, or you can label physics by labeling your states functions of the momentum. And then things have different forms in one way or another, but it doesn't really matter, right? You can rotate from X to P, and there's no difference. And this is, in some sense, the power of quantum mechanics, is that physics is about dynamics in phase space, and quantum mechanics half it. You know, you need to talk only about half of it. The state knows only about half of it, and which half of it you take doesn't matter. X, P, X plus P, whatever. Okay, and it works because there's this bond duality principle, that there's perfect symmetry between space and momentum space. But clearly, GR is fundamentally at conflict with this quantum mechanics problem, because GR says, no, that's not true. Space-time is special, and momentum space is some derived quantity. So clearly, the idea that is natural in this context, which is something that we are developing right now, is to say, okay, well, there may be a new way to put the two together, which is a new geometrical way, which is in some sense to allow now not only space-time to be curved, but momentum space to be curved. And the question is, what does that mean? And maybe I'm going to end up on that, but this is what we have been developing, you know, the possibility to look at momentum space, bigger curve entity, and curving momentum space is in some way a way, it's in a precise way, a way to relax the notion of locality. As soon as you start to have curved momentum space, you start to have you lose the notion of absolute locality. By absolute locality, I mean the fact that, you know, we all experience exactly the same space-time. And if you think for a moment about it, what is exactly space-time? You never experience directly the presence of a point, or this point here, or a moment of time. What you're really doing when you look at space-time, you're kind of reconstructing something. You're, you know, receiving photon, sending photon. So you're receiving energy, sending energy, moving around, touching a point, and moving around means you're sending energy. And this is a combination of this process that you can view as process of exchange of momentum and energy, so a process happening in momentum space that you use to do what's called a localization procedure. That is to reconstruct the map of your space-time around. So now you can show that if you assume that momentum space is linear, that is, it adds nearly, it has a flat metric, then this reconstruction is going to be independent of the type of energy you use. So we all agree on the same space-time. But if for some reason it's not linear, it's curved, then you know the reconstruction procedure is different for different observers. Some sense, and therefore there's kind of a relativity of the notion of locality. So this is what this thing is about. But that's very bold and new. Okay, sorry, I should have talked less and have more questions.
Thank you, Laurent. But I'm going to start off with asking a question, and then you guys So I'm curious about what you said about non-locality. Like there's a version of quantum mechanics, the hidden variable versions, which is non-local as well.
Yeah.
And is there some similar?
No, this is not the same type of non-locality that I'm talking about. It's more. So what you're talking about is the non-locality of entanglement.
Right.
Here. What I'm talking about, but still, even in this quantum mechanics, you still, label things, let's say, as functions of a position. So you still assume that there's that the notion of a position of a point, that there exists a media which is called space-time that exists, and you can label things by that. So now the question is that true, or is it just an approximation? This is this other type of non-locality. So the fact that, you know, we do experience that in the same way, let's say, we call it a relative locality, because in the same way that at our, you know, type of velocity, we experience that time flows the same for everybody. Okay, and then you can ask, okay, well, is it, you know, is it really true, or is it an approximation? We know now that this is not a truth. This is an approximation, and it can be shown, in fact, that it's due to the fact that the space of velocity, not energy momentum, but the space of velocity is curved. This is Einstein's special relativity. If you curve a velocity space instead of being flat, then you have a notion of relative time. Here we are asking the same question. We don't know. We have believed. The thing is that if you look at physics, we have believed forever that space-time is something absolutely universal, independent on the probe you use. We believe that if you look at the universe with blue light or with red light, you're going to see the same thing. But we never, you know, we have not tried to ask the question, what if it's just an approximation for low energy photon? What happens if I really send high energy photon? Will I see a difference, or will I still see the same type of space-time? So at this stage, it's more a question of, you know, it's at the level of a question. You know, you're sitting on an hypothesis, which is a key hypothesis, which is the hypothesis of locality. You know that you have to give it up. The question is, how do you give it up in a controlled manner? And how do you test it? There were lots of information.
More questions?
So it's all clear.
I have a question.
Yes.
So if the momentum space is also curved, and so the space time, can we still use the differential geometry to describe?
No, you have to develop kind of new tools. I mean,
still.
The thing is that if you think about it, think about, let's say, okay, in phase space. So let's take a regular phase space of a particle, x and p. So they are both continuous variables. Both are manifold. Now suppose you curve one, or you make one a periodic. So x is a periodic. So now you put your system in a box. Okay, what is the consequence of putting your system in a box, or of curving, let's say, one particle? Is that the conjugate variable, p, is going to be discrete. You're going to be able to send only discrete quanta of momenta. So curving one variable means rendering the dual variable, the conjugate variable, discrete. So now if you do both, in some sense, you know, if you curve one variable, it's discrete. But if you also at the same time curve it, if you curve the variable, so the space-time you're going to deal with is something which is at the same time discrete and curved. And in some sense, these are, you know, this is a whole set of different mathematical questions to look at. And that's why, you know, this new point of view is fun, because it brings new. Nobody has a proper definition of that. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying if I curve a manifold, I render it discrete. If I render a manifold discrete, it's conjugate variable. If I curve a manifold, its conjugate object is discrete. If I render a manifold, you know, discrete, its conjugate variable is curved. So when you want to do both at the same time, you want to be, you know, you would like to be able to do both at the same time. And there are some examples, like it's called quantum groups. So there's some mathematical example where people have. It's like the Lobachevsky. We are more at the level of Lobachevsky than Riemannian geometry. So we have Lobachevsky plane example, but we don't have the Riemannian geometry. Okay? So we have the first example of something which is kind of curved, like Lobachevsky, but, you know, at the time of Lobachevsky, nobody had the idea of Riemannian geometry. So on the math side, that's something which is exciting to think about. New type of math.
On the math side, is there any way of combining this somehow with the perturbative approach?
With
a perturbative approach of some sort?
Well, at the end of the day, there should be. At the end of the day, you know, if you have a theory of quantum gravity, you should be able to address all aspects at the same time, and you should be able to understand how, let's say, this fundamental cutoff, if it really shows up. So, you know, one of the ideas is to imagine that quantum gravity, because of the length scale, Planck length, of gravity, is some kind of universal cutoff of physics. and therefore, in some sense, it regulates for possible infinities. But then you have to understand how does that, you know, match up with, let's say, non-renormalizability of graviton. And, you know, is it reconcilable? Yeah, it has to be understood. Modular thing, okay, when I, if I want to, and people who are mathematically oriented, one good way to understand the difficulty of quantum gravity is that at the level of math, what you need to do, if you know very well math, you know that there, it's developed into two type of field. There's algebra, there's geometry. There's the left brain, and there's the right brain. And they don't talk to each other. There are people who do pure algebra, and they don't know how to integrate something. And there are people who are very good at topology analysis. You know, you can talk to highly evolved mathematicians, and they don't know basic algebra. They're really completely separated. And doing quantum gravity will mean also inventing some type of new fields of mathematics where algebra and geometry are fused together. So there's a mathematical counterpart to understanding the problem of quantum gravity, which is developing the field of mathematics in a unified manner, you know, reconciling algebra and geometry together. You see, algebra is I don't know, it's like you walk. You know, you're in a landscape, completely landscape, and you take little step. You add cubes, you make, and then you climb up a mountain and say, this is the way we look for prime numbers, let's say, you know. Like, okay, we go like that, and we compute, no, it's not here, and it's not here. There's a higher, you know, and geometry is like you take an airplane, you don't know what's in the ground, and you say, oh, this is the highest peak, right? You take an image, there's millions and millions of pixels, but you can draw a pattern. And a computer is impossible, cannot recognize a face, for instance. You know, we don't know how to do that. Make a computer recognize a face, because you can memorize a face like that, but if I turn it slightly, the computer doesn't recognize it. It's very different. So we need some type of mathematics like that.
Well, I actually have another question.
Mm-hmm.
S equals to A over 4, what's the status of that formula in loop quantum gravity?
Well, there is a counting, so there's a kinematical counting. People propose a way to... So there's a way to naturally get that AS is proportional to the area. To get the 1 over 4, there's a bit of fudging, and we play with extra parameters. So there is a kinematical derivation, which is satisfactory to one point, and we use it to fix one extra parameter, but this parameter is not fixed otherwise. And then there are discussions about, because in any thermodynamical system, there's a kinematical part, let's say the number of degrees of freedom, which is the second law. But you also need the first law. And the first law tells you, OK, what happens if I change a bit my entropy? What happens when I, you know, throw out degrees of freedom? How does the energy change? How does temperature, et cetera? So which is more about dynamics. And that one is less clear, right? So in thermodynamics, you have this first law and the second law. And it's a challenge in any theory to have kind of, you know, both microscopic understanding of the second law and the first law together, like the Boltzmann, you know, version of thermodynamics. That's another way to think about quantum gravity that I haven't talked about, that lots of people, you know, matrix model or people are interested in, think about it in the same way Boltzmann is thinking about, you know, thermodynamics. Think about gravity as thermodynamics and look for the Boltzmann version. That's another way to maybe attack the problem, depending on your sensitivity. And of course, they all should match together, you know, in our understanding. Yeah.
Is there any known relation between a system's notion of relative locality of, I guess, its pieces and the strength of gravity or the amount of curvature?
No, that's a big question. That is so far, that's a big question. It's really new, and yeah, that's a big question. That would be really the core of the quantum gravity equation, understanding exactly what is the precise relationship between having this curvature and the delocalization. You know, we have many arguments that it should be like that. There is some example in 2+1 gravity, we can solve a model where it shows, but nobody really understands. I mean, you know, I say most people would believe there's no relation because it's really a new idea. But for one, nobody really knows how to make that connection. That's, let's say, one of the main open problems if you want to push that idea. But that's a fascinating thing. The thing about, when you, physics is about making, if you plan to become physicist, you at some point, you're going to do that because you want to bring something new on the table, right? And this is why, we always need young people coming into the game. And there's essentially two ways to bring something new to the table. Either you take, let's say there's an old problem and which is open for a long time, and people have tried many, many years, and very good people have tried, and they haven't succeeded. So, and then, you're going to try to solve that problem using the same methods, and then you're going to succeed only if you're smarter than all the people before you. Okay, so that's the first option. You're smarter than everybody that tried before. The second option is to say, well, I'm going to look at it with new eyes and take a new angle. And it's riskier because I don't have a frame and I can just go overboard. But I don't have to be smarter than everybody else before. Because if you think about something for the first time, it's, when it's really on dot, it's easy. It flies. It goes through easily. So these are the two, or any combination of these. So, these type of ideas, what's fun is that nobody has really thought about it seriously before. But, the counterpart is that maybe they're all flaky. They don't hold firm ground. That's always the tension you're going to have all over, if you're really trying to push the boundaries. This is the tension between, and this is the, in fact, it's the tension in any creative process, right? The tension between the being very conservative and then totally out there. And you have to, and the more space you give in that tension, the more ability of creation you have. And you have to find your own way, but you have to explore both sides. If you explore only one side, I don't think it will work.
More questions? So, before we thank Friedel, I would like to encourage you to, when you see those people, that you showed on the beginning of the lecture, I would encourage you to go and ask questions that you may have.
Yeah, even very naive questions.
Yeah, and let's thank Mohan.